Good morning. We're going to pick up where we left off last week with logic as the method of objective knowledge. You remember what objectivity is? The grasp. Objective knowledge is the grasp. I'm not giving you the exact wording, but the idea is the grasp of reality by an active reality-based process chosen by the subject. In other words, by a method which is consistent with the nature of reality and compatible with the nature of man's consciousness. And that method, we said, is logic, and now we're going to turn to look at what it is. Now, some of it you already know. Ayn Rand's definition of logic is the art of what? Non-contradictory identification. The art of non-contradictory identification. And that helps us to specify right away what objectivity consists of. We said we have to grasp reality, but we now know what does grasp mean. What is it to grasp? We're speaking now on the conceptual level. It's not simply to perceive, but to identify, to discover what something is. The process of cognition on the conceptual level is a process of identification. That's one of the key words in defining logic. It's an art of identifying. Every question that you ask, no matter how worded, comes down to what is something. You can say, who did it? What is the identity of the person? When did it happen? What is the time? Where did it happen? What is the place, etc.? Every question you can ask in the quest for knowledge comes down to what is it? The essence of cognition on the conceptual level is identification. And that, of course, is the expression in epistemology of the law of identity. Everything which is something. It is what it is. And all that knowledge can consist of is grasping what it is identifying. So we have now narrowed down to that extent the word grasp in our definition. And now the other key term in the definition of logic, non-contradictory, helps us to begin to define what do we mean by an active process. What kind of activity, what kind of guidance do we need? And the answer there is the process must be ruled by one law. No contradictions. No statement ever that something is and is not at the same time and in the same respect. And of course, the whole rest of our discussion on logic is going to be an elaboration of what does non-contradictory thinking or identifying consist of. But just looking at it so far, is this process, this method of being non-contradictory, is that based on reality? Remember we said the method we use has to be based on reality and compatible with the nature of human consciousness. Is this method of non-contradiction based on reality? Obviously. Why? Because it's based on the law of identity, which we know is an axiom in metaphysics, the law of reality, the basic law of reality. Well, is logic, is this method of non-contradictory identification, is it based on also the nature of human consciousness? Does it reflect or relate to the nature of human consciousness? Because we said the proper method has to also reflect that. And the answer to that question is a very definite yes. Logic is the method of a conceptual being, and it's possible and appropriate only to such a being. If you projected an omniscient entity who knew the totality of reality in a single insight, logic would be entirely unnecessary. I'll put it this way, if we reached conceptual truth the same way that we reach perceptual fact, just in a succession of self-contained, unconnected self-evidences. Every point was just, you looked and you saw, logic would be unnecessary. It's because that is not the nature of a conceptual being, because we organize our sense experience in steps and in a definite order, building new connections, new integrations on earlier ones. It's for that very reason that we need a method of getting from one step to the next. And that method is precisely what logic supplies. So logic is a method reflective of the nature and needs of human consciousness and also based on reality. Now we want to analyze further, because if all I armed you with was go out and identify non-contradictorily, you would not get very far. Although mankind came surprisingly far on that basis alone, because that in essence is Aristotle's contribution. There are two crucial aspects inherent in applying the advice of non-contradictory identification. Therefore, we can say two crucial processes or elements involved in being objective, or say, in being logical. I alluded to that, I think I mentioned it explicitly the last time. And only two, as far as I am concerned. So let's look at them first briefly and then in a little bit more detail. To begin with, we have to understand what we mean by non-contradictory. Well, let's approach that by asking, non-contradictory to what? What is it that you shouldn't contradict? For instance, suppose I give you this argument. I won't take the time to write it on the board, but it's a simple argument for you to grasp. Selflessness is good. Second premise. Suicide is selfless. Conclusion, suicide is good. Is this non-contradictory? Is this, therefore, a logical argument? Is this objectivity? Would this be an example of proper human cognition? It's non-contradictory identification, or is it? This is not any of those good things. The conclusion that suicide is good is consistent with the premises. So to that extent, it's non-contradictory. But the major premise that selflessness is good contradicts a whole realm of knowledge. Everything we know about the nature and desirability of life and its requirements and so on. So this is not an example of non-contradictory identification. It's riddled with contradictions that are lurking in the background that are unexpressed. Therefore, we have to stress at the outset, when we say non-contradictory, that must mean no contradictions anywhere throughout all the total of one's knowledge. And it has to mean that if you search through every single item you knew, everything would be consistent with the particular conclusion in question. Now, let's follow up this just for a moment. How much do you have to search through? Well, knowledge is a whole. If you recall what we said about philosophy being a whole with all the parts interconnected, the same thing is true of the total of human cognition. All of its aspects are interrelated, interconnected. So to be logical, we have to relate or integrate all the aspects of our knowledge. Now, what is the fact about knowledge which underlies this demand, which tells us we have to integrate everything to everything else? What is the fact with the letter C about human cognition that underlies this need to relate and connect every piece of knowledge to the others? If knowledge were simply a set of isolated revelations, you wouldn't need to do this kind of connecting. But it's the fact that knowledge is contextual. So this is one issue we have to explore if we're to understand fully what logic consists of. If we don't understand this issue of knowledge as contextual, we cannot be logical properly and consciously. This is a necessary element. We'll look at that in a moment. But there is one other aspect. You could imagine, and I'm introducing now, just introducing the second. You could imagine that someone would have a floating system of theories that was internally consistent, like a paranoiac in the technical sense. Everything fits into a scheme. You can't trap him in a contradiction because whatever contradiction you think you will force on him, I'll give you an example later, he will amend to cover that. But the whole thing is systematically detached from reality. That obviously is useless, even if he somehow could create this perfect internally consistent system. To be logical, objective, your knowledge has to be brought back to reality, brought back to observation. So the second point, or the second I'm stressing here, is a logical process has to be grounded in observed facts. To derive a conclusion from arbitrary premises is not a process of logic. If I say, for instance, apples are razors and oranges are blades, therefore you can shave with fruit salad, that is not a process of cognition, not at all. That is an imitation of the form of logic while dropping its essence. And if the person said when he heard, he gave that argument, if you tried to refute him and said, well, look, the fact is you can't get rid of your beard when you wipe it with fruit salad, so therefore there's a contradiction. If he's the paranoid type I mentioned, he would say, no, the beard is gone, you just have the illusion of it. From your past memory, but actually the beard is gone. In other words, he can continue to churn out, quote, consistency at the price of rewriting reality. That is not a process of logic, even though formally he admits to no contradiction. The point, however, is this. Logic is the means of objectivity. A logical conclusion, therefore, has to be derived from reality. It has to be warranted by knowledge, which itself probably rests on still earlier knowledge, and so on back until you reach the data of sense experience. That is the minimum in order to be able to say it qualifies as logic. And of course, the name for this process of going back from a given idea all the way back to the sensory roots is proof. So if you want a definition of proof, the process of establishing a proposition's truth by reducing the proposition to axioms. In other words, ultimately to sensory evidence. Proof is the process of establishing a proposition's truth by reducing the proposition to axioms, i.e., ultimately to sensory evidence. That's the only way we can get a conclusion back to reality. So just before we look at each of these more systematically, logic means taking a conclusion and reducing it back to sensory data while keeping it in harmony with all of one's other ideas. So there are two issues here. Keeping in mind the total context, its relation to everything else you know, and going back to sense data. The issue of going back to sense data is derived from what aspect of knowledge? Knowledge is hierarchical. It has a structure. The issue of integrating, connecting, goes back to knowledge is contextual. So non-contradictory identification means to understand that, you have to understand context, and you have to understand hierarchy and their implications to, in order to be logical. Now, I'm not going to give you a long lecture on each of these, but I want to give you something on each of these, just enough to make real what we're talking about here. But I am counting to some extent on my lectures and also on the article on the hierarchical structure of knowledge which was published in the Objectivist Forum because that presents it much better than I can in a brief, digested fashion. Let's look for a moment at the idea of knowledge as contextual. Everything in reality, we're speaking metaphysics now, is interconnected. Therefore, knowledge, which tries to grasp reality, must also try to interconnect its elements. In addition, concepts themselves as a form of knowledge are a means of relating or connecting data. Concepts are a mode of establishing relationships. We take all the chairs, for instance, and we say we're going to consider all of them together in contrast to the tables. We're focusing on similarities, on differences. We're putting together certain things and separating them from others. That is inherently a relational mode of cognition. We're not just staring at one thing discreetly, we're organizing or putting together in terms of relationships. So, knowledge by its very nature is inherently relational. It's an organization of elements, each relevant to and bearing on the others. Putting it negatively, knowledge is not a tapestry of independent truths, each of which can be dealt with in isolation. It's not a heap of self-sufficient atoms of cognition, each of which stands or moves around apart from the rest. It has to be at each stage a sum, a total. And that implies a definite responsibility. You can't ignore all the aspects of knowledge which bear on the one you're thinking of. You can't refrain from integrating, or to put it positively, you must connect the particular element you're interested in to everything else. If ever you take a conclusion, how otherwise innocuous, and treat it as though it was a self-contained unit, unrelated to the rest of cognition, you thereby detach that conclusion from reality and wipe out, invalidate the whole thought process involved. Well, as soon as you drop context, as we say, you drop the means of distinguishing between truth and falsity. You literally drop the means of tying your knowledge to reality. And anybody then can purport to prove anything, however absurd. Now, I worked out a detailed example, which I want to give you from my book, of how this would work out, and I took as the example Neville Chamberlain's argument in favor of appeasement, you know, after the Munich meeting in 1938. And he returned to the world, and he said, in effect, like this, Hitler demands Czechoslovakia. If we give in, this demand will be satisfied. That's true. The result will be, in his famous expression, peace in our time. Now, there is nothing wrong with this argument except one thing. It is entirely in a void, cut off from every other possible piece of information that would bear on and be relevant to interpreting it. He treated Hitler's demand, Chamberlain did, as though it were an isolated element, an isolated fact, to be dealt with by an isolated response. And in order to treat it that way, he had to drop or evade or ignore a tremendous amount of knowledge. For example, he had to drop all knowledge about the nature of Nazism. He didn't try to relate Hitler's demand to anything already known about Nazism. He wasn't interested in causes. He didn't try to relate Hitler's demand to all the things already known about similar demands from aggressor nations and even local bullies throughout history. He wasn't interested in principles. He didn't relate his own action to mankind's knowledge of the results of appeasement. He didn't even consider whether his policy, besides satisfying Hitler, which it did for the moment, would also embolden him, increase his resources, hearten his allies, undermine his opponents, etc. He had a tremendously complex situation. He was concerned to focus only on a single point in isolation, namely Hitler's immediate frustration and how to appease it. And of course, there's much more that he had to ignore besides that. He was pursuing a course of action, Chamberlain, while ignoring the field that defines the principles of proper action, namely ethics. He simply threw the whole subject overboard. He wasn't concerned with whether his course was compatible with the virtues of honor, courage, integrity, and if not, what consequences that would lead to. In other words, he dropped the fact that foreign policy decisions, like all human actions, fall within a wider context, which is defined by ethics and by other subjects as well. He simply wanted, as they put it, peace at any price. And the price included the evasion of political philosophy, history, psychology, ethics, vast realms of human cognition. And of course, the result was war. Now, this type of mentality, the context dropper, thinks that he can influence or deal with a single element, Hitler's dissatisfaction of the moment, an element that exists within a complex network of interrelated factors, and yet leave everything else unseen and unaffected. And in fact, however, a change in one element redounds throughout the network. Every proposal and every idea, therefore, has to be judged in the light of the total picture. In other words, of the full context. And that raises the question, what is the full context? What is the full context? Every aspect of knowledge is interrelated. Every aspect is potentially relevant to the rest. So what is the size of the context you have to keep there for? Can we define some fragment or subdivision of knowledge and say, well, if it's consistent up to that point, that is enough? No, you can't. Precisely because it is a total human cognition, the context you have to keep is the sum of available knowledge, S-U-M. Everything known at that stage of development. That's the only way to be sure that your knowledge is a sum. In other words, a unified, consistent whole. That kind of unity is not a given, but an achievement which requires a methodical, deliberate process. We can put the point this way. How are you to know whether you are contradicting yourself at a given time or not? You hear a new proposal, a new idea, and it sounds plausible to you. How do you know whether or not it is consistent with what you already accept? Well, if you had a magic button, you could just simply press it, and if there was a contradiction that it implied anywhere within the system, your lights would turn orange, or your eyes would turn green or something, then you could just look in a mirror. Unfortunately, we have no such mechanism. We can't compare old contents that we already have automatized and a new idea in some kind of mystic flash of insight. We can't even hold the whole total of our old ideas in any single frame of awareness. Why not? The crow epistemology is just too much. Even if we tried to have this kind of instantaneous total survey, you couldn't retain it all in one glance. So the only way you could possibly check out a new idea and see, is it or is it not consistent with what I already accept, is laboriously, methodically, step by step, you have to work to integrate. You have to relate the new item to the previously known. You have to check out this possibility and this one and this one. This implication and this presupposition. How does it relate to this subject and to that? Would it have any implications over here? You have to search deliberately, consciously, explicitly for presuppositions, implications, applications that might show up in any field, not just the obvious fields, and that might somewhere or other lead you or involve a contradiction. Then if you find a conflict anywhere, you have to eliminate it. You have to go by the basis of the evidence available, and you either say, this new claim is out, it's wrong, or I see that I've made an error, I'm going to amend my old views so as to be completely consistent. Now, this process of integration, of always keeping your knowledge a total, a single unity, by methodical sweat and struggle, step by step, is one element of being logical, and that has to be understood as part of the definition, the art of non-contradictory identification. It is not logic if one seeks consistency only among whatever random ideas you happen to think of on the spur of the moment. If you look at an argument and say, yeah, that's perfectly logical, I can't think of anything inconsistent with it, strikes me as great, that is not yet logic. You cannot pass on count one until you go through this methodical process of searching throughout the total to see whether there are possible contradictions. Only after this active process can you say, okay, this counts as part of cognition. On this test, at least, it follows logic. In other words, being blind, simply not paying attention to the rest of one's views, is not the way to be logical. So we can put it this way. Logic is non-contradictory identification within the full context of one's knowledge, methodically surveyed. Otherwise, logic is just a parlor game. It has nothing to do with reality. It's not the means of objectivity. It's just, a Bertrand Russell type tea party, where you just churn out implications from arbitrary starting points, and what's the use of it? It's not a form of cognition. Now, so I know that most of you, or one half of you, know already about knowledge as contextual, so the point that I want to stress as new to you here, which was new to me, is that until you go through this process of integration and reestablishing a new total, you cannot call that a logical conclusion. Simply because you don't see any contradictions, it follows from its premises, and nothing immediately strikes you as contradictory, that does not yet qualify as logical. Now let's look briefly at the issue of hierarchy. Now we've already discussed this to some extent because at the very outset, we were talking about the proof of philosophic ideas, and we indicated there that knowledge has a structure. One element is built on the next. This follows from the nature of concepts. We build concepts on concepts. We start with the simplest, direct, first-level concepts and then integrate those into higher level and so on, and the same is true with our conclusions. Baby or a child or an adult for that matter doesn't open his eyes and see the law of gravity, say, oh, I see that everything attracts everything with it. So he needs a tremendous amount of earlier knowledge and graded steps before he can reach that. And we summarize this point by saying that knowledge is hierarchical. As I put it, if I can just quote from my article, a brief point here. Knowledge is not like a village of bungalows with every room huddling down against the earth's surface. Knowledge, if you're going to make this comparison to architecture, is like a city of very, very tall skyscrapers with the uppermost story of each building resting on the lower ones and they on the still lower until you reach the foundation where the builders started. The foundation that supports the whole structure by virtue of being in direct contact with solid ground. Now, if every conclusion were accessible directly from observation, then there would be no issue of order. Every item of knowledge then would be a primary. It means first, where you could start with it and end with it and then pick up something else. But the fact is that items of knowledge differ in this crucial respect, in how far they are from the perceptual level, in their distance from direct perception. Some items can be gained from direct, simple sense experience. Others are not so easily available to man. They can be known only through a chain of intermediary and increasingly complex cognitions, each level making possible the next one. That's what we summarize by saying knowledge has a hierarchical structure. That's a terribly big word, but nevertheless, that's the word that we're stuck with as meaning what we want to say here. Now, hierarchy is not that frightening a word. According to the Oxford English Dictionary, it simply means a body of persons or things ranked in grades, orders, or classes, one above another, as the hierarchy of the church, for instance. A hierarchy of knowledge means a body of concepts and conclusions ranked one above another. So it's like a hierarchy of persons, but here one comes above or below in the order of logical dependence according to the distance from the perceptual level. It simply means knowledge ranked in a series of higher or lower, where the bottom here is the perceptual level. That's what hierarchical knowledge consists of. Now, if the fact that knowledge is contextual imposes on us the responsibility of integration, the fact that knowledge is hierarchical imposes on us the responsibility of reduction, taking your knowledge back down the steps until you get it back to the sensory level. Reduction is simply the process of going back step by step through the structure that you traveled until you get your knowledge back to the sensory level. And I gave you an example of that when we did our knowledge of metaphysics and went back step by step. Now that's applicable to all higher level knowledge, and that takes us back to proof. Proof is no more nor less than a form of reduction, of going back down the hierarchical chain. The conclusion that you're trying to prove is a higher level cognition, something that you couldn't get directly from experience. And its link to reality lies in the premises, which eventually leads back to the perceptual level. So when we talk about proof, the crucial thing here to remember is proof is not a process of deriving a conclusion from arbitrary premises, not even from arbitrarily true premises. Even if your premises are true and your conclusion follows from them, that does not make it yet a proof. Proof, to qualify as proof, you have to establish a conclusion by identifying the proper structure or hierarchy of premises. In other words, you have to follow backward, one step at a time, the actual order of logical dependence. And you have to keep going back until you terminate with the directly given in perception. And it's only because you go back that way to reality that you can say logic is a means of objectivity. Now, I'll give you an example of something that is not a proof, even though a conclusion follows from true premises. If someone were to infer a given man's mortality from the fact that there's a huge funeral industry in every country, he says, there's this huge industry in every country, therefore Socrates is mortal, say. That would not be a proof, because the fact of funerals is a consequence of our knowledge of human mortality, not a precondition of such knowledge. By contrast, you're not going back the structure, you're going away from reality in that kind of proof. But if you contrast that with the standard syllogism from Aristotle, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, there the premises are truly antecedent to the conclusion. You know that Socrates is a man before you see him die, and you know that all men are mortal before you even consider Socrates, because all men are mortal in that instance you get from countless direct observations about man and other living beings. So in this way, the argument, the premises are closer to reality than the conclusion. And of course, even the premise all men are mortal itself would have to go back through a lot of intermediary steps till it finally started in, takes you back to direct observation. Now this too has to be understood as part of logic. So we can summarize it like this. Logic requires a recognition of context and hierarchy. It's the art of non-contradictory identification while observing the full context of knowledge, including its hierarchical structure. A logical conclusion is one which has been related without contradiction to the rest of one's conclusions. That's the integration aspect. And which has been related step by step to perceptual data. That's two processes. That's the reduction process. And between the two, you have a double test or a double check on your accuracy. Because every conclusion has to stand the test of your other knowledge and, through the intermediary chain, the test of direct experience. Now, this is the essential, I would say, that qualifies a process as being, or these two are the essentials that qualify a process as being objective or a method of thinking as being logical. If you simply integrate your conclusion to others but don't reduce it back, you ignore sensory data, you are being still non-objective. Perhaps the whole thing is just a pipe dream. You can't say it represents a grasp of reality. If you reduce a particular conclusion very carefully back down to sensory data, but you ignore your other ideas, leave it unconnected, and therefore you leave open the possibility of contradictions, you are also departing from reality. That is not a grasp of reality. But if you check both sides, no one can ask you for more. You have then, within the limits possible to your knowledge, you've brought harmony between your percepts and your concepts. And nobody can ask anymore. You still might commit an error, but as we've already seen, if you do commit an error, this would leave you the means to discover and uproot it in the course of time. Now let's take one example here. Let's take the proposition, man should be selfish. And ask, is this logical? Does it pass the tests of objective cognition? Now, if I were to give you the full reduction and integration, it would be several lectures, even to indicate the high points, because a proposition like this takes in so much territory, redounds on so many aspects of life, and is so far down the hierarchical structure, being way down in ethics, that you wouldn't even know where to start. I mean, I know where to start, but it would take a long time to condense it. I just want to give you the pattern that there are two different kinds of things you have to do. Well, let's ask, first of all, is this proposition reducible back to observation? Now, I'm assuming you know the objectivist ethics here. So I'm not going to give you, but just simply remind you. You'd have to say, well, what do you mean by being selfish? Well, pursuing your values as against sacrificing. Using your mind and exercising your own judgment, no matter what other people expect of you. Never sacrificing your own thought. Well, what would unselfishness then have to be? Well, it would have to be giving up your values and or giving up your conclusion, giving up your mind. Well, you couldn't live that way. So we're taking selfishness back to the issue of thought and values, and in turn, back to the issue of life. If life is the standard, we reduce selfishness back to it's a requirement of man's life. Well, why should we accept life as the standard? How do we relate that back to reality? Well, you know, I'm sure, the objectivist derivation of that, but you know that, I indicated, I think, in our discussion in the question period, every issue of value presupposes life. I think we took the example of listening to music or playing games. Every issue of value comes back to the requirements of a living entity, it's only because there are living entities confronted with a certain alternative that we raise the whole question of value. Well, how do we know that there are these kinds of entities with these kinds of alternatives? At a certain point, you come back down to look, you point, there is an entity. The difference between this entity that moves, that pursues a goal, and that one like the blackboard that just stands there mute and motionless, that's the original sensory data from which the whole structure flows. We start with a direct observation. Certain kinds of entities are goal-directed, others are not. This one doesn't have to do anything to sustain itself. The others are such that if they don't take a certain action, they putrefy, they rot, they die. So you start with that, and then from there, if that's so, the value, and if that's so, certain requirements of life, and if that's so, you have to use your mind, and if that's so, you have to be selfish, you see. So I'm just indicating to you in pattern, there's a whole series of steps down that you have to take to reduce that back down to sensory data. Now, I mean, what I've just said is undoubtedly too repetitive for those of you who already know it, and ungraspable to those of you who don't, but that's the advantage of having a mixed class. But now, even suppose we give, and this I can't stress this enough, suppose we give a really airtight deduction, reduction. Airtight. You go step by step with perfectly clear definitions, and you get right back down to pointing. You see the direct sensory data. That is not yet a logical conclusion, and you cannot stop there. That is not yet cognition. It's a very promising candidate, but it is not yet there, because we have to also apply integration. We have to connect it to everything we know. Otherwise, it is simply in like a candidate. You have to work through, and you have to do this in some systematic way. But I'm here not going to do it systematically. I'm just going to bat out some examples. But you have to say, well, look, you're saying how man should act as an individual. Okay, but after all, we know that he lives in society and he deals with people on a group level a tremendous part of the time. How would this tie into our knowledge of what life in society requires? If we give the most wonderful reduction in the world of man's need to behave selfishly, and then we find out that when you come to social situations, it's simply not practical, that if people were selfish in social situations, they cut each other's throat and die, then we wipe out ourselves. We have a gross contradiction, and there's simply no way to apply it. So we have to go back and say, what the hell happened in our reduction? Or maybe it's just that you should be selfish on a desert island, but it doesn't apply, or what? But you could not leave that question unconsidered, or you would not have reached cognition. And so, of course, then you say, well, the integration here would be the whole knowledge of capitalism and a free society, that there are no such conflicts, and that selfishness works just as well in a political as in an individual context if you have a certain kind of society, etc., and so on. But my point is only you couldn't ignore that, no matter how great your reduction was. And then, as another example, you'd have to say, for instance, this is fine in terms of, you know, looking after myself, but what about personal relationships? After all, love is something crucial, and I value that. How can I, if you pursue selfishness, does that mean you can never love another person? Because if so, then you have a gross contradiction again between something you consider desirable and something you have just advocated a course of behavior. So you have to check into that and discover, well, this already modifies what love consists of. Maybe you had just the vaguest idea of love as feeling good and warm when you're around someone. And now you see, well, I got to tie in love and selfishness. I know I've got to pursue my own goals, and I also want to feel love. How do I reconcile? What's the integration? Then you realize, well, if I love a certain kind of person who represents my values, then I'll be sustaining my life, and after all, that is really what is the kind of love that's most enjoyable, etc. And you make the higher connection. Now, thankfully, if you have a philosophy, a lot of these connections would be made for you, but I'm simply indicating that as a pattern of knowledge, it is still not knowledge until you go through. And this is that spiral issue. You have to revisit other issues. They become clearer in the light of your new knowledge, and each one you tie it to, it becomes stronger that this is true, because this is now the sword that makes social life clear, and political life, and friendship, etc. And at a certain point, you've now woven it so thoroughly that all of your knowledge has been reunited into a total around or including as an inextricable element this conclusion. Now, of course, if at some point you think of the idea of God, even if it doesn't occur to you right away, 2 weeks later, 2 months, 2 years later, somebody tells you, what about God? And you hadn't thought of it. You say, now I got to stop here because God's word is that you're not supposed to be selfish. And yet, I had this conclusion and it connects to so much else. Now, I got to integrate this. I have to connect this. And of course, at a certain point, you're going to see it's one or the other. And if you continue God, then you blow up the whole thing. If no matter, you put yourself in the position then that the omniscient voice of the universe demands one course of action, and every other thing you know, every other aspect of your life and everything you observe demands the other, and if you accept that two half, you know nothing then. You literally know nothing. You obliterate all of your knowledge because one half wipes out the other. And then you're in the position of who can be sure of anything, which is the main reason people are skeptics. It's not that they are corrupt, but that they don't go through this methodical integration, and therefore they feel that any new idea that they accept, who knows what's going to come up tomorrow or next week or next year that could blow it up. They have no method to accept it to begin with and no method to unite it all into a total. And therefore, they don't feel sure of anything. That is the single real reason why skepticism is so widespread. Now, by contrast, take the proposition, man should be selfless. And try the two tests on that one. And you will see the epistemological state of mankind by how hopelessly it fails on either and both. First of all, there's no argument. There's no reduction. You are told to be selfless. Why? God said it. Now, it's the revelation. It's not taken back to reality or any observations or any requirements. It's just it's in the Bible. That really is the source because the social type gets it from their religious upbringing and then simply secularizes it. So it has no roots in reality, and that's the common idea. Morality is irrational. There's no such thing as a logical or scientific morality. Morality is just arbitrary. Which means right away, it has no reduction. It has no base in the perceptual level. It's detached from reality, from the structure of human cognition. Well, then, of course, you can integrate it. You don't even know where to begin to integrate. But going to that test, do the advocates of selflessness methodically go around and say, now, how would I apply this to be completely consistent in social life, in personal life, in this aspect, in this aspect? And not only do they not do that, they go to great pains to say, don't do it, because if you do it, you'll die right away. And they know that perfectly well, and so their phrase is, don't go to extremes, be moderate, don't be academic, do it some of the time when you can get away with it, don't ask me for principles. Consistency is the last thing we want to try to be in this particular thing, because even the medieval saints were careful to eat enough so that they didn't die right away. Now, in other words, if people had the rudiments of the idea of reduction and integration, it would be inconceivable that they could accept such a theory, which is grossly unintegratable to anything and no base whatever in reality. And that's the negative example. This is the essence of what being logical and therefore of what being objective consists of. Now, I just want to conclude this point by saying you see, I hope you see the tremendous originality of Ayn Rand in this regard. Because this whole progression flows from what element in her philosophy that we started with last time. From the theory of concepts, which was her unique epistemological contribution. And that in turn gave rise to the concept of objectivity and to the definition of it. And that in turn gave rise to the need of the method of logic. And that in turn gives rise to the need of integration and reduction. So certainly other thinkers have been objective prior to Ayn Rand. So it's not as though she was the first or started the process of objectivity. But they were objective in the same way there were many, many individualists before Ayn Rand. She didn't originate individualism either. But what's common in both of those concepts is there were many advocates who understood them partially, but no one who understood them all the way down to the root and who could therefore validate them completely and tell you how to carry them out. No one could tell you how to live by individualism. And no one could tell you how to apply objectivity in all the complexities of daily life. And that's why today the common viewpoint is objectivity is unattainable. They say, well, you have to be omniscient to be objective. And of course, that is not true. It doesn't require omniscience. It does require a method, a very specific method that you can only understand and validate if you start with a certain theory of concepts. And since philosophers are the only ones who deal with theories of concepts, and they're all intrinsicists or subjectivists, the mass of mankind has no idea what actually the process of being logical or objective consists of. And that's what I think is Ayn Rand's deepest philosophic achievement. She was the first to base a definition of objectivity on a proper theory of concepts. And therefore, she was the first to define this crucial cognitive issue fully and to specify the means by which men could actually adhere to it and achieve objectivity. I'll put it to you in a summation like this. This is my last paragraph on her in this chapter. Ayn Rand was the first thinker to identify the fact that logic, including the recognition of context and hierarchy, is the method of achieving objectivity. This is the knowledge that was necessary to make objectivity not merely an elusive ideal, but a human actuality. It is this knowledge that enables a man not only to base his conclusions on reality, but to do it consciously and methodically, i.e., to know that he is doing it and by what means, i.e., to be in control of the process of cognition. If there are landmark discoveries in human thought, this is one of them. Now you know why she called her philosophy objectivism. And that takes us to the end of our discussion of epistemology. Now I think what I'm going to do at this point is take a few questions now, and then maybe near after we had some questions, make an advanced start on the next unit, because it's pretty long, the part on ethics, and maybe I could get some of the introduction to it today so we can plunge right into the middle of it next time. Now, do we have questions on this unit of objectivity and logic? Yes. That's it, yeah.
Yes. In the example you gave, you went through the process of reduction for the the process of integration. Barring cases where you have a gut feeling that something can be integrated, you might start there first. Do you usually start with reduction first?
Yes, I usually do. There is no absolute rule as to the order that you go in. If somebody gives you something bizarre that you see on the face of it contradicts something you already know, and that is really thoroughly known to you, you can just throw it out right there. But if it is some new area or area that you're not that at home with, the first thing is to see, without prejudice, can you relate it back to reality? What is it based on? So you just for the moment say, all right, I want to set aside the rest of what I know. I want to see the steps. How do you take this back to reality? And then, in the process, you will find often that that is very illuminating about what the thing actually means and how to even interpret it, because you now see what in reality gave rise to it, and that is very helpful to the process of integration, because the more specific you are about what it means, the more you know what you're integrating. And from that point of view, it's better to first relate it back to reality and then try and integrate, because otherwise it's just like a floating abstraction in your mind. But as I say, there are times when you know enough to know this whole theory is crazy and I'm not even going to bother with it.
You just have a sense that there's something here that doesn't make sense, and I better look at what I think that is first.
Well, if you know that, yes. If you know that, if you just have a sense and you're not sure, perhaps the best way to find out whether the thing is it makes sense is to hear what the argument is. What are the steps that connect it to reality? But it's not worth doing that if it's some incredibly tortured invention put forth by some diabolical philosopher. Because, for instance, you're not a specialist in philosophy and you hear some Kantian conclusion. If you wanted to trace back his through all the coils of his intermediary structures, and you'll never get back to reality anyway with him because he denies the whole thing, but you'll get back to Hume finally through immense coils of chaos. The only value of that is if you're going to get a PhD and then you have to teach it to somebody else, but that is not a form of cognition. That you, if you're not in that field, just throw it out right away. So we're talking within the realm of human behavior. Yes. Oh, actually, not the lady next to you. Oh, you're right. Yeah. Go ahead.
You had not properly integrated this idea, and therefore doesn't actually, strictly speaking, qualify as knowledge. If you act against it, is that a moral breach?
Well, you're asking me really what amounts to this question. Suppose that you haven't integrated an idea fully. Is that, was that your word? And then you act against it. Is that a moral breach? Well, the question is, what do you mean by fully? If you haven't really integrated it significantly at all, then it really isn't knowledge. And so the moral breach, if you know about objectivism, comes in the fact of accepting conclusions in so irresponsible a fashion. It's irrelevant then whether you act on them or against them, because the point is you have defaulted on the basic responsibility of establishing a tie between your conclusion and reality. So your basic immorality there is irrationality. And then whether you act on it or not doesn't make any difference. But now if you have integrated it substantially, but it's just, you know, you haven't been able to cover everything. Well, it's very hard to cover everything. And that would be a terrific way out to say, well, look, I'm not omniscient. I haven't integrated it to every other thing, and therefore I can ignore this piece of information, even though I've reduced it and integrated it to 37 things, because I'm not yet, you know, integration is contextual. You integrate within the context of your knowledge. So if you are in a position where you say, within the realm of what, let's take a practical test, okay? I mean, just a completely, grossly arbitrary one. If it's within the first 5 minutes that you heard it, and nothing strikes you as negative on the count of integration, that doesn't qualify as integration. But if you think about it, and you try, and you explore, let's say, 5 other areas, and it's 2 weeks later, and you still can't find anything, I will decree that that qualifies as enough knowledge so that it's immoral to act against it. Okay? Now, obviously, that is arbitrary, but I'm simply trying to indicate knowledge is contextual, and integration is contextual. Integration is done by essentials. It's not done by quantity. So if you're going to integrate, from the very nature of the idea in question, should point out to you the main areas to look at. For instance, we're integrating, man should be selfish, that was the example. Well, this tells you right away that it has to be connected to the field of ethics, the field of values, the field of right and wrong. You know that it has to relate to your knowledge of man. You know that it relates, therefore, to anything that gives you prescriptions about how man should live. And that includes, as the obvious outstanding examples, God and the state are the two big candidates telling you what you should be doing. So you're pointed right away, even in relative ignorance, by the nature of the proposition, to what areas you have to look at. On the other hand, there's nothing on the face of it in that proposition that directs you to subatomic particles. And therefore, there would be no point at the outset in saying, well, I want to be methodical and integrate to everything, so I'm going to start studying the nature of, you know, positrons or whatever. On the other hand, that doesn't mean you can say, well, to hell with physics, because sure enough, at some point, New York Times is going to come out with the idea that the latest discovery of positrons or whatever proves that there is no cause and effect. And if that's true, that annihilates the whole field of ethics and the whole necessity to act by any means. So now you have to say, well, that is now a direct clash with my proposition that man should be selfish. And now you have to integrate, you see, because you realize that the link connecting them is cause and effect. In that way, all I can say is this. It's not integrated until you've gone through the essentials and you continue to do it for life. But once you've gone through the essentials, which particularly for a knowledgeable audience like this one should not take forever, then it qualifies as knowledge that you have to act on. Does that answer you? Now, the lady next to you, yes.
Yes, I'm Jerry.
I'm sure I see a lady there. No? Oh, I'm sorry. All right.
I'm
not long for it.
I've had this problem all my life.
No, I can't. I just couldn't see. I don't know. I must have mixed up hair. Okay, yeah.
I'm going to change my barber. If someone gives you an argument for God, which is a very highly metaphysical argument, and you can see if there is some element of it that you can lead directly down to first principles, do you have to argue all the way back to, for instance, if they say that God exists, and you know part of the definition of God is that he's pre-existent?
The hard question is this. How do you deal with arguments given for God? Do you have to refute the argument if you know that the conclusion itself is inherently contradictory? I would say, no, you do not. If that is not your field, and you know that the conclusion is riddled with and is inconsistent with every element of metaphysics and epistemology, and that if it were true, that would collapse man's whole means of cognition, including all argumentation, that is sufficient to say this idea can't be reduced to reality, it's in defiance of reality. It can't be integrated with our other knowledge, it collapses all other knowledge, therefore I can reject it out of hand. And if the guy is given some maniacally diabolical argument, you can simply dismiss that as this is obviously a stolen concept. This guy is using argument to annihilate the foundations of argument. Now, that would not be sufficient for a philosopher. A philosopher would have to be able to see through the trick. He would have to be able to say, and it's easy to do because there's only a few arguments for God which come up over and over, you know, in countless different forms. He'd have to see what gimmick is being used here. Now, it would be professionally obligatory on him to go through at least all the main varieties, because he's interested in what are the distortions of cognition and how do they reflect false theories and so on. So a philosopher that said, I know it's wrong, but to hell with it, would be derelict. But that is a specialist's knowledge. It is not mandatory. Now, the only caveat here is you have to be sure you really know what you're talking about when you say, I know this conclusion is false. You have to really know that. But assuming you do, it is not your obligation to go through all the details of diabolical inventions. And there are tremendous amounts of such. There's extraordinary ingenuity devoted to making the bizarre plausible. It's a waste. It's a dead end. You should argue with a few religious people to get an idea, but you can get that very quickly. The best would be to read a Thomas Aquinas. Nobody ever was as good as him, and he gave you 5 arguments, and you can pick among them. That should be ample to last you. Yes. No, well, I have to tell you, you're right.
Can you explain how the process of reduction relates to deduction and induction, and in particular, isn't induction going from sensory or observations and going back to the general, isn't that an opposite of reduction?
Yes. Induction is the process of generalizing. But all proof can be looked at as going in either direction. Either you start from a conclusion and take it back, like an inductive conclusion, all men are mortal, itself requires a proof, i.e. requires reduction. And the reduction consists of going back to the data, the direct observational data that led to that conclusion, such as it would go back in this instance to instances of people dying, concrete men, and I think also of this being true throughout the realm of life, animal and plant. You'd have to see a number of instances, don't start me now on induction, but you'd have to see that it happens in a variety of countries, a variety of climates, to both sexes, no matter what your occupation is. And at a certain point, you generalize. So you are inducing. Induction has, even the very definition is complex, but let's restrict it to the process of generalizing. That itself requires reduction to the data which led to the generalization. Deduction is a different form. That's a process of applying a generalization to a particular case, such as starting with all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, but still that conclusion, Socrates is mortal, has to be reduced back to the generalization which it rested on, and then that in turn back to data. So induction and deduction are forms of proof, but both of them require a process of reduction. Doesn't make any difference which type of proof you use, you still have to obey the test of reduction and the test of integration. Yes. Now I want 1 question per person. Yes.
Yeah. Could you give an example to illustrate how you could prove something and then invalidate it by persons to agree?
Well, that depends. Could I give an example of how you could prove something and then invalidate it by a process of integration? Obviously, you wouldn't actually have proved it. That is, taken it back to reality. But you might find, when you integrate it, that you interpret it differently than you fully understood. And the example that we mentioned is the one of selfishness. Suppose you established selfishness as a matter of proof, and you had independently decided that you loved somebody, and that love was good, and you now try to integrate the two, and you think there's a contradiction, which happens to many people. And they say, well, you should be selfish, but only up to a point. You have to leave room for love. Well, there is an incomplete integration, and the result is they haven't used the knowledge of selfishness to clarify the knowledge of love, nor the knowledge of love to clarify fully the knowledge of selfishness, that is part and that's involved in pursuing selfishness. So there would be a case that you can't use the knowledge properly and apply it because of a failure of integration. In other cases, you may think that you had a proof, and the perfect example of this is rationalists. Rationalists regularly give airtight proofs, you know, deduction step by step from unassailable premises, and the conclusion flies in the face of everything else they know, but they simply write off everything else they know. They don't bother with integration. They just simply throw it out. In fact, we had a proof here last Saturday that the guy didn't exist. By deduction, if I exist, there must be certain requirements. Those requirements haven't been met, therefore, I don't exist. Now, if he followed simply, quote, giving a proof, it's airtight, except he's overlooking the fact that there's a little integration that he overlooked here. If he doesn't exist, how did he account for the fact that he does this, 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 etc.? There's a gross contradiction there. It is not enough, in other words, to say, I have followed the chain down. Knowledge is very treacherous, particularly with rationalism rampant, where people just derive ideas from other ideas and think, well, now I've reached the self-evident in a floating chain. But even without that, you need these two elements to support each other. You need to unite your knowledge not only to percepts but to your other concepts. And you need that to be sure of either link and also to clarify what the real meaning is of your concepts. We have about 10 or 12 minutes, so this is an abrupt transition now. It's terrible to do this right before lunch, but it's better than walking out in the middle on Thursday and saying goodbye. I want to turn now to the topic of ethics, which many people will breathe a sigh of relief at, because this is much, I guess, easier, although it's not that easy. But I want to turn specifically to the topic of moral principles. That's what I want to be on for this whole next, this is our last unit. What moral principles are and why they are necessary. This is something that most people do not grasp, and even a great many very dedicated objectivists. They don't grasp it in the full sense that I want to be presenting in the next several sessions. I had an extremely intelligent student, extremely honest, who could not grasp why you have to be honest. He had no desire to be dishonest, but he simply couldn't grasp why honesty was an absolute. And he would say, how do you know always in advance that honesty is to your self-interest? What about if you knew you could make $1 million by telling a lie? The chances of being detected were virtually nil, and you would use the money only to spread objectivism. He could not grasp it. And the discussion finally resolved itself not into honesty at all, but into what is a principle and why are principles necessary. And only then did he see it. Of course, he sees it now. Or I've also heard about Rourke, and I know that many more people think this than have the courage actually to ask it. What would be wrong if he compromised occasionally? Why does he have to be so 100% pure? Look at how many years he wasted doing nothing, just sitting around idly, I've had it put to me. What if he compromised a few times, so a couple buildings wouldn't be that good? But he would get money, he would get a name, he'd get himself established right away, and then, now that he would have clients and so on come, he could be, you know, all those years productively employed doing perfect buildings, and at the end of his life, in net total effect, if he blasted out the earlier buildings, he'd have a greater volume of work than otherwise. Now, this is what I call, these two examples, the trade-off approach to morality. That is, should I be honest? Should I have integrity? Well, let's make a list. What's the trade-off? What are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? And then, within that, whoever uses this trade-off approach, by the fact of using it, says, how can you possibly know in advance that it's always going to come out that it's bad? Don't you have to weigh in a particular case? What guarantees that your trade-off has to come out negative? And yet, you have to weigh the consequences of an action. Actions aren't an end in themselves. So how else weigh except by consequences? How else judge consequences except by trade-off? And how do you know that a trade-off has to always end up on the side of morality? Now, you can see, I'm sure, that this applies to any issue. People who say, well, I believe in going by reason, but I don't see why I can't occasionally have faith in something or other. I mean, I'm not going to go around and be a religious zealot. But every once in a while, I get some advantages. It's comforting, for instance, to believe in God. It makes me popular, and so on. I'm not, you know, going to go whole hog on this, but why can't I weigh in a given case whether to go by reason or faith? Now, of course, you know, this is the essence of pragmatism. Pragmatists do not say, always be dishonest, always do evil. I mean, it would be much nicer if they did. They say, there are no absolutes, experiment, try and see. And many people who are not pragmatists, or in fact who dislike pragmatists actively, cannot really see all the way down the reduction of principles all the way back down to reality. Obviously, you know that this applies in politics. All the mixed economy advocates who say don't go to extremes do not grasp the role of principles. Those who say let's judge controls in each case by the circumstances and the consequences. Let's have a trade-off. Granted, this control interferes with freedom. Maybe in a given case, it'll help out the poor more than it hurts liberty. So let's weigh and balance. That's that same trade-off approach. And of course, that absolutely is taken for granted as an axiom of our any discussion of politics today, which means that people take for granted that principles are absolutely out of the question. They just don't exist. Now, I was sure that if I understood anything about objectivism, I understood the role of moral principles. I have been an absolutist personally from the very beginning. I always was an extremist. I hated moderation in anything. Despite that, I feel that it's only within the last year that I have really come to grasp with a new clarity why acting on moral principles is so essential. And as I indicated in the opening lecture, it was writing on the virtue of integrity that finally opened my eyes, and I saw that there was a deficiency in the full step-by-step reduction of the issue of moral principles, and that when you get that, the whole of morality just falls wide open before you. Now, I assume you are motivated. Now, the background or context, I'm just reminding you of any discussion of objectivism is that life is the standard, the ultimate purpose, which makes the whole issue of values arise, and that morality, therefore, is entirely a means to an end. Plants and animals act automatically. You know this. They don't need ethics. They support their life. Just automatically, they have no choice. But man has volition, he has choice. Morality is the science, really, of self-preservation. Now, that's what I want to develop. How do we get principles out of this setup? Man as a being with choice, trying to sustain his life. That's the foundation that we need. Now, if I asked you, we have a couple of minutes, if I asked you, where would you start in reality? With what fact of reality would you start If you want to end up with the need of principles, or to put it another way, what is the basic fact about human life that requires, by a long chain, the need of living by moral principle? I hesitate to ask it, because if you tell me the wrong thing, that's going to throw us off. But out of curiosity, suppose we start with, man exists, he wants to remain alive, he wants to follow something or other as guidance in how to do it. What is the first fact that he has to take into account that will lead him step by step to the whole idea of what is a morality and what it should consist of, etc.? I'd just be curious to know what you would take as the primitive here. Yes. No, we're starting with man has choice, but now he wants the first fact that will end up giving him guidance on how to exercise his choice. The first fact about human life, about his action, that he would discover very, very early. Yes.
The crow?
Well, that's a fact about human consciousness, about epistemology, and he wouldn't discover that probably for a long, long time. No, I mean something gross and obvious that you will learn in your earliest conceptual observations.
Yes.
That's a law of reality. Now apply that to the way you have to act. Once you grasp cause and effect, what does that tell you about how you have to behave? Just that in and of itself. To get something, let's put it this way. You want something. You have to do something. It's not enough, therefore, just to do the thing of the moment, because you want something in the future which requires a certain process of you in the present. Right? So you have to pay attention to more than the present. If you want to satisfy your desires or get anywhere, you have to pay attention to more than simply the immediate present. That's one of the earliest things you learn. Now, how would you put that in a hyphenated word? You have to be long range. That's the first, the beginning. Now, let me give you a definition of long range. That's where I would start. Long range means allowing for or extending into the more distant future. I got this out of a dictionary. Allowing for or extending into the more distant future. A man is long range to the extent that he chooses his actions by reference to such a future. That means he sets goals that require him to follow a course of action extending across some significant time span. It may be weeks, months, years. And since he's concerned with such goals, he weighs effects. In other words, the future consequences of his present desires and behavior. A short-range man, by contrast, is simply one who is indifferent to the future. He wants the immediate satisfaction of a given impulse without thought for any other ends or results. For example, I'm making this point about long range. I myself am being long range and making it because I have a goal in the distant future, which is Thursday in this case, to culminate in your grasp of principles. And therefore, I'm doing this with an eye to a significant time span. And for that very reason, even though the thought just occurred to me, let's say, that I would have a great desire to talk about what I'm going to have for lunch, I brush it aside, I push that impulse aside, because that's simply going to detract from my long-range goal and confuse you. And that is a simple model about of what is long-range versus short-range. Focus only on the immediate impulse of the moment, or be concerned with a goal across time that requires a course of action and that requires you to observe what you're doing and see the results on that goal. Now, on Tomorrow we're going to develop the implications of this and hopefully reach the issue of moral principles. Thank you.